two Michaels, Professor Michael Tipton, MBE, and also Michael from WIT. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Damien.
Good morning, Damien.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Are you going to win the Grand Slam?
That's a big question. Let's say yes.
The championship.
Depend which England team turn up. The one that played in the semi-final of the World Cup or the one that played in the final. Ireland met the one who played in the semi-final. It was a cracking game, but we'll see. We'll see.
They're going very well at the minute. Thank you very much for joining us, Professor Michael Tipton, MBE. And also we have Michael Harrison, WIT Professor,
Head of Department in WIT.
What is the department, Michael?
The Department of Sport and Exercise Science in WIT. It's one of the largest sport and exercise science departments in the country.
And what is your speciality?
We have a very broad range of specialisms in the department. We have nutrition specialisms. We have sport and exercise science. We have a specialism in physical activity, the development of physical activity policy and the evaluation of physical activity interventions. And we also have specialisms in our oldest courses in the recreation and sports management sphere.
I'm told that this man in front of you is quite a modest man. How important a man is he in terms of the talk he was giving?
Professor Tipton is a very, very accomplished UK
going red
academic. We are very fortunate to have him as a visiting professor in the department, linked to the Department of Sport and Exercise Science. He has a very, very long publication rate. He wasn't awarded an MBE for no reason in terms of his contribution to society. And he is the editor-in-chief of a prestigious journal in the UK, Experimental Physiology, and we will put his talents to good use.
What do you think of that?
No pressure, then. Follow that. My area is extreme environmental physiology, so I'm a professor of human and applied physiology. And that, I mean, does include things like altitude and heat and etc. But my first love was cold water immersion. And of course, that's a major problem around the globe. We have about 1,000 people a day drown somewhere around the planet.
1,000 people a day?
1,000 people a day. And that's probably an underestimation. That works out about 360,000, but they think it's probably closer to 1.2 million. In Ireland, you are losing about 130 people a year. You lose a child about every 6 weeks to drowning. It's the second or third most common cause of accidental death. And so that's been my primary focus, and that's really what brought me over here yesterday to work with the Life Saving Foundation, and I'm very honoured to receive the Ireland Medal, which was a recognition of the work in that particular area, and also to do today with my inaugural lecture as a visiting professor at WIT. So it's been a whistle-stop tour. I have to go back this afternoon, but it's been really worthwhile, and I'm really looking forward to this collaboration with.
I'll talk a little bit about the more specifics in a minute. What's going to happen now, Michael, in terms of this collaboration, this new dynamic, I suppose?
Well, the next plan is, after Professor Tipton's visit here, I intend to go over to the University of Portsmouth, and we will hash out a plan in terms of how we can best use his talents. The visiting professorial scheme at WIT involves one visit annually to WIT and a public lecture, and after that it's up to myself and Professor Tipton to negotiate a programme of interaction that may involve staff exchanges, student exchanges, but I'm particularly interested in his assistance in working with our research staff and our PhD students in terms of assisting them, mentoring them and assisting them in getting their publication rate up.
People that may not know better, Professor, will think drowning is drowning. You can't create a career about talking about drowning. Like, it's, you drown, you drown. It's one of those layperson type of misconceptions. Mm. Continue sometimes to dog the coverage of this. Mm. And yet, I know from talking to John and different people within, and I've written a book myself,
I've seen it,
that investigates some degree just on the surface of that. There's so much more to this.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, historically there were people fishermen were classic, who wouldn't wear a life jacket, for example, because all that was going to do if they fell overboard was prolong the agony. It was as if drowning was an inevitability. It's not an inevitability. It can be reduced in terms of number. In fact, over the 30-year period that we've been working in this area, and not because of our work necessarily, but we've seen drowning, for example, in the UK fall from about 750 to about 400 drownings a year. And what I think people need to realise is drowning is a process. And for me, that process starts with ignorance in a community. And that's why a lot of, I mean, we focus our research on prevention, search and rescue and treatment. And to some extent, you've failed a bit if you get to the bit where you're doing the treatment. Because if you can empower people and educate people so that they understand the risks and they don't enter into those risks, then you know prevention is much better than cure in this way.
And I have prefaced this talk and this discussion with a warning that some people will be upset by this discussion, because there are people listening to this who have relatives who have drowned. This idea of why are you talking about this? Why are you? Is there some way? Are we to blame, or our community to blame for this, because, or our relatives to blame, that we didn't insist on certain procedures regarding fishing? It could be angling, it could be children going on holidays, and John has spoken about that as well. So you can understand how difficult a topic it is sometimes, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I give around about 35 invited presentations a year all around the globe, and often the audience for those presentations include the next of kin of people who have drowned. And one thing that happens, and I think is part of working through the process of having had somebody drown, is people want to help, they want to understand, and they want to make things better in the future. And some of the biggest advocates of drowning prevention and drowning research are those that have had have lost their nearest and dearest to drowning. And it's not a matter of you've done something wrong. We're not blame storming, we're not in that process. What we're saying is that, as society evolves and as our understanding of the process of drowning evolves, we can mitigate and we can intervene at different stages to try and reduce that problem. I mean, drowning used to be something that it was all about search, rescue and resuscitation and treatment. So it was all at that end of the spectrum. And of course, you'd have your rescue organisation quoting how many rescues they'd done. We've done really well this year. We've had 500 rescues or 400. And you start to think, well, if you're having to do that many, maybe we could stop this down, upstream a little bit. We could actually say, well, maybe you should be judging the quality of your preventative interventions by the smaller number of rescues and resuscitations you have to do, rather than justifying existence by the large number.
Michael, what do you think of that message?
I think it's very appropriate here in the southeast. We are so close to the coast. We use it for recreation. We use it for commerce. I think everybody along the coast, when you hear the helicopter out, or you hear of a boat that's in trouble or that has disappeared, it really resonates. It certainly resonates with me as somebody who lives along the coast.
And this idea of working with the Life Saving Foundation, collaborating in some sort of a structured way, I know we were talking to John about the library as well. How can the professor's message be rolled out there into the communities in a measurable way? Like, we'll talk about the metrics in a minute. What do you think?
Well,
how can WIT get involved?
Well, it was actually as a result of a research project that WIT did get involved with the Life Saving Foundation. It was looking at the post-traumatic stress experience of first responders who come on the scene of a drowning. They're sometimes forgotten about in terms of the range of people who come across individuals who have, as part of the drowning process, sometimes the first responders and their trauma can be forgotten about. And there is a study that has just
been completed at the moment, that is getting the views and getting the experiences of the first responders.
Professor, that question about the metrics, again, the measurements and the going from the ivory tower of the college to actually those that are participants in activities which can unfortunately lead to drowning.
Yeah, it's a really good question because, of course, you know, alluding to what I said earlier, it's much easier to say how many times you've launched a lifeboat or a helicopter has gone and done a rescue. It's much harder to say how many times somebody thought about something that was said or they heard and they didn't do something, so something didn't happen. And that's a real challenge. What I can say is, you know, part of our work has been involved in public awareness campaigns such as in the RLI's Respect the Water campaign, where people are not only have the dangers of immersion explained to them, but they also get told what to do if they find themselves in the water. To float first, rest, relax, get the first 90 seconds out of the way, which are the most dangerous period of immersion. And we have had, the RLI in particular, have had, I think now in excess of 20 unsolicited emails from people who have said, I saw that TV advert, or I saw that radio, I heard that radio advert, and it changed what I did, and I think it saved my life. Now, I guess an unsolicited email or a message is worth its weight in gold in that situation. But you're right, it's very hard to get strong metrics that say. But, I mean, we're currently working, trying to get a very simple set of messages into schools. And I know other Irish water safety organisations and the Life Saving Foundation are doing the same. Because if you can teach kids what happens with tides, and let them understand the water. I mean, it's fine. It's difficult to imagine, but there's lots of people turn up at a beach not realising the water comes in and goes out again.
You're right.
I mean, those that live by the sea make the assumption that everybody knows these things. There's lots of kids who don't know what a rip is, how to recognise one, or what to do in a rip. And we have lots of evidence of people getting caught in rips and turning around and trying to swim straight back to the shore, becoming exhausted and dying. Whereas if they'd have swum 5 metres left or right, they'd have been out of it. What to do when you first go into cold water, rest, relax, get your breathing back under control. Just those three things from the analysis of accidents would make an enormous difference. Now, you know, if somebody's heard what I've just said and they remember that, that's a life-saving message they'll take with them for the rest of their life. What we're proving at the moment is that you can teach that to 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds. Their water safety knowledge will improve and they'll retain that information because we're testing them before and after the assembly or the lesson, and we're testing them 3 months later, and their water safety skills and understanding increase and stay increased. So now I can't then tell you how many of those people went on not to drown.
Yeah, of course.
But you have to make the assumption, as we do with lots of education, that this is a beneficial piece of information.
Yeah, it's like seatbelts in cars. When nobody was wearing a seatbelt in a car, there was a way of obviously measuring deaths and potentially, but with this, the reduction of deaths is one way of measuring it. And then I presume anecdotally people will hear it, people working on coastal communities, people working in life guard facilities, whether it be in hotels, you'll notice it's a cultural thing as well, is it?
It is. One of the big things we're trying to get people to do is not only understand that message themselves, but start a conversation to talk to other people. Because, as I say, just a few, you've got to be careful not to overcomplicate things. It's just a few simple messages: tides, rips, cold shock, and people start talking to other people. And you're right. I mean, eventually you should see this reflected in a reduction in the number of drownings. But of course, that's a pretty slow evolving and debatable metric, because those numbers change with weather. If you have a good summer, for example, so you know, but it will come out in the wash over time. But it's not easy to get a very fast response.
How frustrating is it sometimes where you're trying to talk to somebody and they're saying, no, I just got to do what I got to do, and I've always done this, and it's never bothered me, you know? Did you ever meet anybody like that where you're banging your head against the wall and you're thinking, come on, listen to what I'm saying?
Well, a vast majority of adolescents, as I have ever met anybody, most of the people I mean, the thing about the drowning messaging is it's quite interesting because it comes from people like myself and Michael, and you know, you're talking about WIT, etc. But actually, your target group are particularly the sort of 15 to 30 year olds that are pretty inaccessible to academics. So that's one of the reasons that we have to be really smart about the way we get the messages across. So, you know, publishing in the scientific literature is great for academics, but there's not going to be many young men read those papers. So we have to work. And the nice thing about what we do is we're providing information, and we provide that freely, open access, and then we want all the different organisations across Ireland and across the planet, indeed, to take those messages and use them. But we've also got to be smart about getting onto TV, getting into the media. I mean, somebody asked me to write a paper for a magazine called The Lad Bible. I don't know what The Lad Bible is. I'm kind of pleased I didn't, because I mean, but apparently, you know,
the lads read it, yeah.
That's what they read. Mm. And now, okay, it wasn't written in quite the prose that I would normally choose, but there it is. The message is there. And that's what we have to be smart in our messaging.
There's an area down near Tremor called the Guillemine that Michael would know very well, and to have dozens upon dozens of boys and girls on a summer's day, a summer's evening, jumping off this area, and it's quite safe. But again, you could imagine, Michael, a public information exercise down there, literally targeting, talking to those people. What would happen if they jumped in and they suffered cold water shock?
Cold water shock. And that came up this morning. What we have in Ireland every year is we get hot spells so infrequently that the country goes mad when we do get, and then you get particular, and it's nearly predictable that regularly when we get periods of hot weather during the summer, you invariably get reports of drownings at some point. So I think education,
and they're needless. They're so needless. There's no need for them. Yeah. And they're taking out a group that had so much potential.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about young people. And it is such a shame.
Devastation for the families.
Yep, I think it's all about getting them, and that's why I like the idea of getting this as a compulsory component on the school curriculum, because you know everybody's, lots of people are doing really good things, but it ends up being a bit piecemeal. And I mean, you know, okay, I'm not knocking things like signs, but, you know, most adolescents are not great at reading signs. So we've got to find alternative ways of messaging. And it may be that word of mouth from, you know, teenage advocates. You get a bunch of youngsters who are interested in this area. You train them, you get them involved, and they go out. Because teenagers are much more likely to listen to teenagers than they are to some grumpy old bloke coming along telling them not to jump in. So, I don't know, we have to be smart.
We spoke about the peer influence, and you do certainly see that around the Guillemine during the summer. The risk takers...
P-E-E-R rather than P-I-E-R.
P-E-E-R, yes, P-E-E-R. Where they climb the rock to see who can go the highest before they jump in, sometimes not cognizant of whether the tide is in or whether it's out, because the difference between the high tide and the low tide at the Guillemine is 2 metres. So the young adolescent certainly is a target group, the young male adolescent.
I know there's a lot more on the Life Saving Foundation as well, and we'll put more up on our website. Michael Harrison, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Professor Tipton, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure meeting you, and please come back into us next time you're over, and we'll follow this up, okay?
Be great pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks very much, gentlemen. Damien?